Hello and welcome to a special edition of Politics Weekly with me, Allegra Stratton, and my partner in podcasting, Tom Clark.
Yes, with 2009 drawing to a close, we're here in the Guardian's King's Place headquarters, and as they used to say at the start of Cheers, we're recording the whole thing live in front of a studio audience.
Joining us to look back at the events of last year are three giants of the British political commentariat.
So please put your hands together for your panel, The Guardian's Polly Toynbee and Simon Jenkins, as well as Nick Cohen from The Observer. Well, thank you all very much for coming along. First of all, we thought we'd kick off our extravaganza by unleashing the ghosts of political past.
Because this was the year that we all learnt what a duck house was, and indeed an MP could claim for it. When the expenses scandal broke, we thought that out of the manure also claimed for would come reform. But Simon, you wrote at the time that it was a rare revolutionary moment. Did the revolution come and go?
Well, rare revolutions never actually take place. They're just wonderful to contemplate in prospect. I don't know. I think it was curiously quite important. I just think that British politics... I never ever use the cliche, won't be the same again, because it will always be the same again. But there's no doubt at all that MPs, as people of reverence and distinction, will not be the same again. And I don't think it matters really what they do. I think they will always be seen now as rather like ordinary people. When you show them money, they'll take it.
Forever. I mean, people could talk about it taking a decade to heal. You think it will never...
I don't know, and they've got, who knows, they've got a big job ahead of them. I think that an election will purge them to a certain extent. I think a new expenses regime will purge them to a certain extent. So they'll recover, yes, but it's been a dreadful year for that profession.
But Polly, what it's not been is a revolution in the sense of changing the way we do politics. And a few months ago, some of us were hoping it might turn out to be like that. What do you think the great lost moment was, looking back?
I think there was a chance for looking at the whole way that the House of Commons runs itself internally, from freeing parties from their whips to some degree, like allowing them to choose their own heads of select committees and chairs of select committees and those sorts of things. I think, though, it was a chance, really, for looking at how we elect the House of Commons. We've had these sort of experiments with open primaries. I'm very dubious about them myself. They cost £40,000, and they're going to be like American politics. They're going to be, rich men. It'll be more men than women will be able to buy themselves seats if we go that way. But the lost opportunity for proportional representation, looking again at cleaning up the whole system of electing MPs, that's very sad. But this is going to rumble on. The next lot of expenses are going to come tumbling out. The whole thing will kick off again. And I think at the general election, incumbents are going to have a very rough time. And, most of the incumbents are Labour, so it's going to hit Labour very hard.
Nick?
Well, I agree with Polly. I think that there's going to be an insurgent election in 2010. Incumbents are going to be hit very hard. I disagree, though, on I think it's been a wasted opportunity in the sense that we haven't faced up to the real crisis in Britain, which is the crisis in our banking system. Partly being very useful for a lot of people, that all the hatred has been directed at MPs, who, when all is said and done, were on the fiddle. They weren't actually even corrupt, in the sense that they were taking money from vested interests to do it. Now, I'm not justifying them at all, and my blood can boil about them as much as anyone else's. But the reason why it's not a revolutionary moment is precisely because we're not concentrating on the real problems in front of us. I would be quite shocked at the end of all events this year if not a single bank has gone to prison, but MPs have been prosecuted.
Simon, we're going to get on to banker bashing in a second, at length. But is that correct, that it's the expenses scandal in a way was a diversion from a seriously massive moment to restructure a political economy?
Well, the conspiracy theory of politics was that was the entire intention of the whole thing. It was to divert attention. It just wasn't.
Unleashed by the Telegraph.
It was a cock, yes. It was a cock-up, not a conspiracy to that extent. I don't know. I think to be fair to MPs, we don't need to say that.
You can be fair.
I think that there is now a quite ludicrous expectation placed on the job of MP. It's quite interesting that as comparing this with an American friend, and they said they couldn't understand this. These MPs were expected to be legislators in Westminster and local elected mayors at home. An MP now has all the obligations placed on them. that elected officials have in France, Germany, and America. And that's the long and short of it. I mean, you now go to your MP for a planning inquiry, for your children not happy at school, for something goes wrong with the NHS. All these things in other countries aren't dealt with by central politicians.
I think we've got to remember, though, that MPs were hugely despised before. In the chart table of who was most despised, MPs used to come just under journalists and just ahead of debt collectors. And now, ahead of journalists. And now journalists have inched 1 point ahead of politicians. And if you go back to reading Trollope or anyone, the idea that there was a golden age when people had reverential attitudes towards politicians wasn't so.
Actually, funny enough, Polly, Trollope is about the only author in English literature who afford politicians any respect at all. It used to be in the 20th century when politicians were asked to name their favourite author. They're not done now. No one expects people to read books anymore. They'd invariably say Trollope, because if you go for the rest of English literature, there's just nothing but... You know, the English have always thought the politicians
are
liars and corrupt.
But the mobs in Trollope and the voters don't think much of the politicians. You don't get the feeling a general sort of social... doffing of the cap to politicians.
But can I ask each of you, just as a yes or no question, whether you think we're going to see a serious deterioration in the quality of people who want to be MPs, given it's, as Simon says, so much more demanding?
You really want a yes or no answer?
Well, you can expand if you like.
I think ambition is ambition. I think it's a high-profile job. People who are interested in politics will always want to go into Parliament. I don't think there'll be any appreciable difference at all.
They'll have to fund themselves, won't they? They'll have to fund them. They'll have to have an income already.
I think it's getting more difficult to be... To work your way up to the status of being a likely candidate, unless you've had quite a lot of help in terms of internships at the beginning and ways of going to work for people for almost no money, or working for think tanks for almost no money. They're all in London. How are you supposed to live? Mm. You know, there's a danger that it's an increasingly middle-class occupation, as are most of the professions, because the trade union route really doesn't exist any longer.
We may get better politicians. I mean, call me a cockeyed optimist. Simply because if they are living on less money, they might be less tolerant of the super rich in Britain. They might be more concerned about the bills that the average family face. I mean, there's a huge... The media in particular overestimates what the middle class is. I mean, the Times is the worst of this. The Sunday Times, they call people on incomes of 100,000 a year or 150,000 a year middle class. That is the very top of society. A salary of £67,000, mm-hmm, for most people in Britain, including most of the middle class, is a hell of a lot of money.
It's about three times the average.
I suppose the question we wanted to answer, actually, is how many people here would have on their contemplations of things they'd like to do to be an MP? One person, two people, three, four, five. Not too bad.
You were going to join? Firstly, Labour, and I was asked the same question by Tony Benn this year. Why would I want to become an MP? The idea being that I could do something and change something. I'm a law student constantly frustrated by the law in many areas, especially the Constitution. Yes, I mean, I go to a law school where the average 94% entrants go to private school. I'm one of 10 in my year that went to a comprehensive. This is not Oxford, this is UCL. I am the front lines of knowing where Britain has got unequal. And that's not to disrespect my friends. They've done very well and worked very hard, but it's just the opportunity that you have from coming
when
from...
When you consider that studies show that to even run to be a candidate costs about 50 grand, is it something that would put you off?
No, because...
How would you fund it?
How would I fund it? Well, I want to go to the bar, so I'd probably say I'd have to...
It's a short... Personal income.
Personally, it's unfortunate, but yeah. I think the only route is either state funding, which will never happen, because the left will never accept giving money to Nick Griffin, and the Tories will never accept giving money to John Crudders. So the parties themselves have to... What the parties have to do is reinvigorate. We only are down to 200,000 each of the major parties, Labour into it. That's ridiculous.
I mean, okay, very good. Bit of speech.
does anyone on the panel want to react to the point about state funding and whether that might improve the mix?
I'm very strongly in favour of state funding, and I think we might get it. I mean, I think that's one of the disadvantages of the... one of the disappointments of not seizing the revolutionary moment was that if ever there was a time to persuade people that we needed to clean up everything to do with money and politics, that was it. I know it's not directly related, but it is really You think of all the scandals of people, you know, right from the beginning with Bernie Ecclestone of soliciting funds. I think that was, you know, the first moment of Labour's beginning of Labour's downfall. And I think that we could persuade people.
It's a long time before
state funding is worth it.
Lady standing up at the back.
I think what you've been alluding to is a crisis of leadership.
Can you just say who you are and if you're from any organisation?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if my employer will allow me to say so. I am from an organisation. I work in the voluntary and community sector.
Yeah.
And basically, it seems to me, my question is, where are our leaders? I'm sorry, but being wealthy and going to Oxbridge doesn't qualify you to run the country. And that seems to be a concept that the British don't seem to understand. Where are our leaders? And who is going to stand up for regular people? Who is going to stand up to the banks? Who is going to stand for regulation? It's very easy to pass laws that favor your friends and your wealthy colleagues. It's very difficult to pass laws that stand up for vulnerable and marginalized people. So where do you think our leaders are going to come from?
That was a good speech question. It was both. Amazingly both. Nick has just politely put his hand up, so you go and then Simon.
What I find quite interesting about what's happening in Britain at the moment is, you say, go to Eton, go to Oxford. The political parties, the Tories more so than Labour, ever since Alex Douglas-Hume, have been desperate to avoid getting symbols of the old British ruling class as their leaders. You know, Heath, Thatcher, Major. It's almost, if Cameron makes it, and I suppose there is still some doubt, if he does, it's almost a sign that Britain is the new elite, the public is thinking the new elite has failed Britain, and they're almost going back to an old ruling class that you fought in terms of being Prime Minister, had just gone. I mean, when Douglas Hurd took on Major, the fact that he was someone from Eton and with old-fashioned manners was held against him. He thought the Tories to be unelectable with such a leader. So if it comes back now, it's a sign of some social change in Britain.
Simon, can you pick up on the sort of absence of leaders rather than necessarily the class point that, again, we're coming on to later?
Well, we have leaders in this country, and they're called prime ministers and chancellors of the exchequer. And you have two so-called proletarian ones at the moment, and they gave into the banks to a degree that I could not believe. Mm. I genuinely don't think that Margaret Thatcher or most Tory leaders would have honoured the toxic debts of RGS at 100 pence in the pound when they were worth 1 pence in the pound. And completely failed to reflate the economy in a recession, which is what this government's done. So I think this endless quest for reasons in class background is a mistake. It's just a mistake. It's an easy way out of having an argument about what the policy should have been. I really don't think, whatever people in this room may think about David Cameron, that you'll get a reading out of what a Tory government would do as against what a Labour government would do, or a old Etonian government would do as against an ex-comprehensive government would do, from looking at educational class background. I just don't believe it. I think it's become the great excuse, and we shouldn't let it through.
Oh, Simon, if only the Tories had stood up and said, be more radical, be tougher on the bankers, sock it to them. I never heard any of the Tory front bench say a word of that.
I totally agree.
And if only they had, it would have strengthened Labour's arms.
Why didn't they, Simon?
You better ask them, not me. I screamed. I think there was a consensus which came out of all of us, including The Guardian, that bailing out the banks was a good thing to do. When a banker says to you, I'm too big to fail, you capitulate. The Americans told us that was the case. The number of bankers in the centre of power at the moment is unprecedented. I mean, not since the Edwardian period have so many bankers been given admission to Downing Street. I'm not particularly left-wing, but I wish the trade unionists had been there in as many leagues as the bankers had been, because you would have had some demand reflation. You would not have had this bailing out of every bank that came along. Madness.
Shall we now use the chance to turn to pre-budget report? Alistair Darling's speech contained all the advertised banker bashing that you heard about over the weekend and this morning, as well as his plans to squeeze public spending. The one surprise being a sort of more general tax rise for just about everyone else. Polly, there's been a fair amount, and we've just started to hear some of it here, of talk about class war, class conflict. If this was a declaration of it, it was a typically mild Alistair Darling declaration of war, wasn't it?
It was very mild, very sober, came from the voice of the country's bank manager. I think it's quite disappointing, really, because if Labour had a year ago said, right, the bankers are going to get it in the neck, and if that had been the story, if that had been the rhetoric, instead of which, very slowly, the way Labour does eventually sometimes get round to doing something mildly radical, they wait until everybody else has put huge pressure on them, until public opinion is safely on that side, and then they'll put a toe in the water. And this really is only a toe in the water. It's for a very brief time. A lot of the bankers will find ways round it, though there are some quite good anti-loophole mechanisms in it. You know, I'm very glad they've done it, but they've done it with as little political credit and kudos as ever. They often do good things slowly, too little, too late, and fail to get any of the kind of enthusiasm and red-bloodedness that they could have done if only they'd, from day one, said, that's what we'll do, because it's right.
Nick.
I'm often reminded of, have you seen the German film Goodbye Lenin, about the mother who has a heart attack and her whole family have to pretend that Berlin Wall hasn't fallen and communism is still there? I'm often reminded like that with sort of the attitude of Brown and Darling, is they still think the old world is carrying on and it's going on as before. And it, only I think now, certainly last year, you know, they thought, well, you know, nothing can change, we'll just get back to where we were and go on. We haven't had... You talk about sea changes in politics. We've had a sea change in British history. In other words, the system of how we were managing ourselves and financing ourselves that developed in the 80s, that period has come to an end. And sometimes I think Gordon and Alistair have been the last people to notice that.
Simon, for me, it's not a particularly clear class war, because they've also picked a fight with the unions, haven't they? I'll fill you in. They've also said that they'll cap public sector pay at 1%, and Dave Prentice has gone ballistic, understandably. So it's very difficult to get up running this class war narrative that anyway they possibly didn't want to do quite as starkly as it was briefed last week, when they're also doing this. Will they have trouble with the unions in the next 12 months?
Well, I've never followed this class war spin of the last couple of weeks. I don't know why they put it about. It was never going to work.
Don't think it will be something they'll deploy occasionally in the next 6 months?
I really don't. I mean, I think I come back to Margaret Thatcher's thesis that, you know, the trouble with the working class is they want to be middle class. I mean, you don't go on insulting middle class people and in the guise of so-called insulting toffs, and then hope that the working classes are going to vote for you, which they were going to do anyway in the case of Labour. The whole thing is crackers. It's sort of schoolboy psephology. apropos of the so-called mini-budget, it seemed to me to be rather a cunning operation. I mean, Darling was basically saying, there's no huge crisis here, so I won't have a huge budget. Mm. I'll do a little bit of tinkering here, a bit of tinkering there. I won't get Polly excited. I'm just going to sort of pretend it's steady as she goes. The sea change is not in British politics. The sea change is in British public finance. We're going to be paying for a very, very long time to bail out those banks. And as an old-fashioned monetarist, it was a stupid thing to do. You should have let the banks either go bankrupt, or he should have announced this week he's going to call in the loans. Then you'd have seen real sweating. But you do not ask the workers of Britain, in every sense of the word workers, to take a pay cut in order to honour utterly toxic debts at 100p in the pound. You don't do that to the government of Zambia. It makes no sense for an old centre-rightist like me. You give the money back to the people. Let them spend it.
Polly, why have they done it? It's pretty peculiar, isn't it?
I think they were convinced, and I must say, Simon is very much in the minority, that, you know, most of the economists, including those who were begging for much more radical action, you know, people like Blanche Flower and others, do think that, you know, to let the banks crash was an absolutely terrifying prospect. You know, it has been blackmail, but there really wasn't much choice. I mean, if Simon had been Chancellor of the Exchequer, would you really have dared? Would you have looked down that precipice and said, I believe my monetarist principles are right, we'll do it, and hell, we'll see what happens? I don't think there are very many people who would have really dared do it. But I do think that the politics that then had to follow was to say, right, everything has to change from now on. We are not going to blow up another great boom, which we're beginning to do already as house prices rise again. Everything's taking off again. The green shoots they're looking for are little green balloons. and there's no sign at all that anything fundamentally has changed about what we see as the good economy.
Aren't you all being just a little bit downbeat, though, in the sense that the government has today announced that it's going to do a specially earmarked tax on one sector where that sector chooses to pay its people in bonuses, big bonuses? This would have been absolutely inconceivable a year or two ago, wouldn't it?
Margaret Thatcher had windfall taxes on banks' profits. Geoffrey Howe did it. It's not. It's a sign of how we got caught up in the bubble mentality, and a sign of how odd British society came. That you can say that that's an that's an inconceivable thing to do. In a funny way, I would rather than taxing bonuses, the government would do some radical reform of the system. We'll go back to the Glass-Steagall. Actually, they will not do it. I mean, Bank of England screams to do it. Start splitting banks up. Start making them boring. And then, if people want to speculate, they can. But if you speculate and lose, you lose all your money. Don't expect other people to pay for it.
That option was available to them. I mean, it was heatedly discussed was whether you just nationalise the major banks, which is what they did in the First World War and the Second World War. You effectively nationalise the banks, you separate them off. They did it in Northern Rock, and they said, right, we're not honouring these dud debts. They're written down 50% or 90% or whatever you care. They're written down, but we're protecting depositors' money. It was something, frankly, probably if I had been Chancellor, I would have done. Particularly, I'm a Labour Chancellor. They were mesmerised by these bankers. I mean, they sat there ogling.
No, I agree about the nationalisation, but that's a slightly different question. I absolutely agree about that. Of course, they should have taken complete control. The idea of protecting shareholders was a ludicrous idea. You know, I think what the real missed opportunity here is to try and stop the bubble taking off again. If they had put back the capital gains, if he'd done that today, to where Lawson set it, so that you couldn't avoid income tax, and, you know, it didn't matter how you made your money, there was no incentive to describe it as one thing or another, and they'd set it back at the 40% rate or 50% rate now. If they'd had a decent property tax, a land value tax, then again, we would have stopped the property bubble taking off from here. It wouldn't have taxed people in retrospect for their previous gains, but it would stop a whole lot more speculation in property.
Before we go to questions, we haven't really looked at opposition positioning. Some people feel that the polls are narrowing. We had an eight-point lead for the Tories this week, which again puts us nearer to hung parliament territory, which we might talk about later. And that one of the reasons that they give is that the Tories' line on public finances has been too damn gloomy. They're always talking about the deficit. They've only themselves outlined £7 billion worth of cuts. It's actually less than what we've heard today and over the last week from the government. So they're almost being outflanked and kind of swinging cuts. Simon, is it a sort of overdone media narrative that the Tories are being too gloomy, or do you think that actually they should probably start talking about growth a bit more?
I have the foggiest notion. Better people than I spend their entire day studying focus group returns and polling results, and they can't answer your question either.
This is a party 6 months away, they think, from forming the next government.
I think they have absolutely been wrestling with how do you respond to this, in the same way that the government has. I mean, has the public been so petrified by the finances of the country, in the same sense that they were petrified by terrorism, that they're prepared to tolerate almost anything to relieve them of this horror? And I think it's a part of the British politics of fear, which is an obsession of mine and very, very serious now. If you terrify them enough about terrorists, they'll pay anything for their defence. They'll even be searched every minute. If you've terrified them enough about banks, bloody things, they will somehow or other cough up more taxes. Now, since the Tories, as Polly says, have been party to this terrorism of finance, they're all in this bind now. Do we appear super responsible, or can we get away with being magnificently irresponsible? I think probably if I was a cynical politician, I'd say, for goodness sake, stop being so gloomy. Pretend we can cut taxes and cut public expenditure, and there'll be no damage anyway, and just see what happened. As it is, George Osborne appeared frightfully responsible, and he's been punished for it.
Can we have one question here from the audience?
Thank you. My name's Anthony Lyon. We spent most of the years talking either about MP expenses or the banking crisis. So which issue has snuck by unnoticed or been sidelined because of those two?
The war. Costing an unbelievable amount of money, quite apart from the deaths. It's doing no good at all. It's building up further wars ahead. And it's forcing the nation itself collectively to spend ridiculous sums of money on security. I'm against the war.
Any subjects under the radar this year, Polly?
Well, the perpetual subject that underlies everything else that is a social problem in this country, which is rising inequality. And, you know, every time whether you're looking at failures in education, at failures in rehabilitation of criminals, or wherever you turn the spotlight to things that are not going well, it is that fundamental growing inequality that's at the bottom of it. And yet it's the thing that politicians won't really talk about. They'd much rather talk about how you have more league tables for schools than point out that overwhelmingly a school's results are determined by its intake.
Nick?
One of the most notable things about Britain in the past 20 years is how class has stopped being talked about. I don't mean class in the sense of a rather childish sense of David Cameron went to Eton. I mean, frankly, what is the difference between Alistair Darling going to Scottish public school and David Cameron going to an English one? But the lack of interest across right and left in what has happened to the English working class. White English working class boys are now the biggest failures in schools. And hopefully, if any good comes out of the recession, there will be a far greater focus on looking at people who are underprivileged and stop cutting them up by colour and religion and gender and sexuality and
that's
all the substitutes.
All the substitutes. Why do you think that?
I don't know. I mean, just why will that happen? It probably won't happen, probably, will it? No, I mean, the middle class left is in some ways as bad at this as the right. Something that might make it happen, Polly, is the rise of neo-fascism in Britain. People are appalled by it, and because of that, they are starting to confront what's going on in the slums and estates of these cities. But you ask me what's not being talked about, what's not being looked at. There's that. You know, we bail out the banks, we don't bail out Chorus. We give bonuses to bankers, we don't give. You know, it's such a shocking thing that's happened in the city. You see how the wealthy, when they're in trouble, the state turns them and bails them out. Perhaps we might get a little more focus on the real causes of disadvantage and deprivation in Britain.
Well, now to 2010 and the next election. I don't know whether it's sort of too closely scrutinised or not. In my profession, it's pretty damn closely scrutinised. But it looks like it could be one of the most closely contested in, well, since 92. But Jim Callaghan talked about sea changes in describing 45 and 79, where moments when suddenly the country had enough. Simon, ahead of this election, do you think there's a feeling, and do not say you have not the foggiest idea, because you do this for a living, do you think that we are at a Callaghan-style sea change, or do you actually think that this could end up being a sort of inconclusive election?
Elections are very funny things. You mentioned 92. I mean, 92 was the only time in British history that any party's got more than 14 million votes. Mm. John Major's victory in 92 was absolutely stunning and staggering, particularly after 14 or whatever it was years of Margaret Thatcher. And he was simply, in popular terms, the most popular prime minister we've ever had. I mean, the electoral, as Polly would say, the electoral arithmetic denied him a strong overall majority, but that's not the point. But coming on to David Cameron, I mean, it would be truly amazing if David Cameron doesn't win the next election and become Prime Minister. I mean, if he didn't, it would be an absolute sensation.
It requires a swing of 7% to get a majority. Always, can bore on.
It always requires things, I know, but given what's the history of the past 2 or 3 years, it would be extraordinary. However, you're quite right to warn us that miracles can happen. Miracles to the Guardian, at least. But, I mean, I don't think it's going to be a sea change. I do think that both the fact that both parties are more or less agreed about the financial crisis and more or less agreed about the war, which are the two kind of determining issues of you know, things people talk about in the pub.
And in your view, more or less wrong on both counts.
And more or less wrong on both counts. Well done. The change that comes in with David Cameron, I don't think will be epochal. I just don't. Also,
not even if he does the big bang of localism that you talk about wanting in your book.
Well, I'd love them both to do that, but equally well, they're both timid on localism. I mean, neither of them really believes in it. They're both obsessed with central government power. Gordon Brown has been just as outspoken as David Cameron against central government power. They won't do it. I'm completely sceptical on that front. But on the main point, I think if you, as you rightly point out, it's our job to do, if you talk to the leading personalities in both parties, they honestly don't disagree in the sense in which they did in the 40s, 50s and 60s. They sort of have common assumptions. They sort of think they've got to do more or less the same thing on each policy. They struggle desperately, I mean desperately, to find things to disagree with each other. And they normally fail. So I'd be surprised if you saw a revolution. You will see a changing of the guard, yes.
Can I be a political anorak? In fact, yeah. If I can't be a political anorak on the Guardian Politics podcast, where can I be? The reason why I don't think it's going to be a very close election is one Simon alluded to when he said John May's got 40 million votes. From 1992 through to 2005, the reason why May will get such a tiny majority is people like me and Polly would see a Tory candidate in a marginal seat and we'll vote whichever way we could to stop the Tory winning. Tactical voting helped decimate the Conservative Party. Blair doesn't win in 1997. Everyone talks about Blair's great landslide. He only gets 43% of the vote. It's not a landslide in electoral terms. Now, I think tactical voting, I think anti-Tory tactical voting is pretty much dead now. I think if I'm a Liberal Democrat and the Labour candidate says to me, you've got to vote Labour to keep Tory, I say, no, I'll vote for what I believe in. There might even be anti-Brown tactical voting. So I wouldn't get too drawn into the opinion polls looking close. We want it, of course, because it's a better story. And secondly, the opinion polls always, always, always overestimate Labour support. Every time you can test polling against the real election, it's the poll that's put Labour at the lowest that is the most accurate.
Do you not think polls now, it's unfashionable to be Labour, might be doing the reverse? People might be shy about being Labour.
Shy Labour supporters. There's an interesting reason that they do the same with the Greens.
Some of them
incidentally. The Greens are always far higher in opinion polls than they are in actual elections. I assume it's left-wing audience, I believe. I think there's quite a comforting thing, if you're on the left, think of that, is that when a polling company phones up, someone on the left is far more likely to help out a stranger for nothing than someone on the right say, why should I do that for, and slam the phone down.
The reason I think it's not going to be a sea change is I think it's almost certain that Cameron will win. I just can't see people going into the polling booths and saying, I'm going to vote for that nice Mr. Brown for another 5 years. I just can't see it because I can't find many people who feel that. And old Labour voters, all sorts of Labour voters, people who voted Labour at least the last few times, I just think they're going to balk at it. I think they won't put their eggs for Brown. But I do think what happens after the election is going to be fascinating, and it's going to be very like 1980, 1981. It's going to be pre-Falklands Thatcher. I think whoever takes over is committed to huge cuts. I think they're insane and unnecessary. You know, Labour's got this absurd law saying they're going to cut the deficit in half, which absolutely strangles any possible sensible reaction to the state of the economy as is in any one given year. But anyway, the Tories are going to do it even more so. So there'll be huge cuts. I think there'll be riots of the young unemployed again. I think we'll go back to that as we had in St Paul's and Bristol and Brixton. I think the disaffected youth will be very angry indeed. It'll be a dreadful time, and I don't think they'll be in power very long. I don't think a war will get them out of it this time, because people have had enough wars. I don't think there's any opportunity for a Falklands rescue. And Labour, if it can then pull itself together, find itself a reasonable leader, and keep its nose clean and not do anything idiotic, will be back quite soon.
Can we take views from the floor now on what's going to happen this year and why?
Hi, I'm a student. I'm also an unpaid intern in Parliament, trying to make my way in the world. I guess we've talked a lot about Labour policies, Conservative policies, and I'm just wondering, I guess, where the Lib Dems come into it, having come off fairly well in terms of Vince Cable and the economic crisis. And I know you alluded to the fact we might talk about hung Parliament, but just where they come into it, I guess.
Not according to this lot.
Lib Dems just got to hang on. I mean, they're under huge threat from Conservatives in the south of England. If they can just hang on to most of their seats. And then perhaps what Polly says doesn't happen. Labour does not do well when it goes into oppositions after periods in government. It went wild in the 30s. It goes wild again in the 80s. If Labour just has a small... If the Conservative government has a small majority and Labour can regroup and it doesn't get taken over by the far left. Yes, of course it could be
well,
back.
Where
but
is the far left? I mean, if Jack Rudders is the far left, he would have been regarded as the far right in the wild days. I mean, I don't see any of this wildness. There isn't a sort of secret militant tendency waiting to take. I mean, if you remember, after I've lived in Lambeth all my life, just about, and if you remember what mad Labour was really like in parties like that, there is not an inch of it anywhere in any Labour Party that you come across.
I'm just saying, historically Labour doesn't cope well with defeat.
We're going to go for one more question. Obviously, there's lots more you guys. Maybe you could speak about it later. What's your name and where do you come from?
Hi, Joel Fenster. I'm here from London. If David Cameron does win the election, do the panel think he'll be able to control his own party, or will it be torn apart?
Good question. Which to go out? Nick, do you want to start?
Well, that's interesting. If you go back to Blair, the start of Blair, you might not remember that. He was supported across the board in the Labour Party. I mean, Peter Kilfoyle and Mo Molan nominated him for Labour leadership. And Labour has had this huge crisis in the 80s. It had lost its socialism, it's lost its faith, as Simon was saying, it was going around chatting up city bankers, going to the bankers, not having the bankers come to them. And there was just across the board in the Labour Party a belief that we have got to do something completely different. I don't sense that belief on the right of British politics. I don't think that they have given up on a lot of ideas. I don't think that it's very telling on global warming that they accept it from Cameron when Cameron's just as a marketing ploy, as a rebranding to use all this sort of degraded and debased language. They don't believe in it. They don't want it. They don't, and there's huge outcry on the right now about doing anything about it. I don't sense the change in conservative Britain that there was in Labour Britain in the 90s. So, yes, I think he will have lost trouble with his party.
Simon?
I agree. Conservative leaders always have a lot of trouble with their parties, as Labour ones used to. They're now much more compliant, as Polly says. It is true that the right of the Conservative Party, although it's a quite difficult thing to identify, but it exists on Europe. I mean, UKIP is a sort of ever-present threat to the Conservative Party. It certainly exists. It will exist, should he pull out of the war. I think he'll have a lot of trouble on that front. It does exist on Europe, no doubt at all about it. And I think it sort of rumbles on matters of immigration and race and so on. Although I don't think that's very serious. I think it's one of the remarkable things in British politics is how that issue has on the whole been neutralised compared to the 60s and 70s. But Tory leaders have what might be called participatory parties. They have trouble all the time with them. I think Cameron's a good leader. He's disciplined. He's firm. He does listen. I think he's a very interesting British politician at the moment, before he's destroyed by office. And to that extent, I think he'll be as well able to cope with it, and better able than Thatcher or Major or for that matter, Heath was. But it's going to be a rough time. It's going to be a rough time for everybody.
It all depends what or who you think he is. And we don't know. So far, if he is not of the right himself, he's capitulated to the right on every single actual concrete policy, starting with Europe, catastrophic European policies, pulling out of the EPP. And I can see them setting themselves up for a fight about Barnier and Barnier being against the great British city. That's already brewing, and I think that Osborne and Cameron will go along with that quite happily and find themselves new people to fight, new enemies in Europe. And I don't see any appetite in Cameron himself for doing anything other than fighting Europe. If you look at their actual his actual declared policies so far, they are all policies entirely there to please the right of his party. If you look at his tax policies, inheritance tax, giving back pension relief and cutting back on the 50p top rate, all of it going to the top 2%, richest people. He'll talk about, when he came to the Guardian the other day, the Hugo Young lecture, he'll talk very movingly about poverty and community. He'll talk about global warming and hug huskies, but not one single policy has come out on those fronts at all, not a single one. So that I'm not sure that he's in conflict with his party. It seems to me that they're quite happy to allow him to make softy speeches, so long as his policies remain their policies, and they are.
Just one little game. We started off with a word that most of us have probably never heard of or seen in a catalogue for garden furniture, duck houses. When we look back on 2010, Polly, what would be the word that will end up embodying the year in politics? I think it'll the government will want it to be fairness, but it possibly might end up being eaten. I'm sorry. I know you disagree.
You think it's eaten? I think it's deficit panic.
How much do people in the supermarket talk about deficit?
I think the odd thing is that they do, because they've been so brainwashed.
Polly shops. She shops at Harrods.
Asked, right, if people are asked, what problem does the country face, they tend to regurgitate whatever they've heard, and they'll say, oh, it's the debt, isn't it? And, you know, it's not true. And it's very that's been the Tories' great victory, is to persuade people that the problem is the debt.
Fair enough. Simon?
Too big to fail.
Nick?
Decline. I think we're back now in the narrative of the 70s of Britain as a declining country, unsure what to do about itself.
Not going to have you back in, Nick. Too depressing.
Dear, oh dear, I think I'm going to cut things.
What are you, Tom?
I'm going to cut things out with the word cuts is probably the one. It's going to be real cuts and not rhetorical cuts as we move into 2010.
So we should now show our appreciation for everyone on the panel to Polly Toynbee, Simon Jenkins and Nick Cohen.
I know lots of more of you wanted to get in, and I'm sorry you couldn't all, but if you want to leave any comments on anything you've heard today, do so at our blog at guardian.co.uk/politicsweekly, where you can also listen back to any of the podcasts from last year.
That's it for now. Our producer's been Ben Green, but also we should say hi to Francesca Panetta, who normally produces Politics Weekly and is not well. From me and Tom, thank you to our audience, and thank you at home for listening.
Thank you.